Hey everybody, welcome back to the Marvel Bronze Age. I'm Ed.
The good old... Wait for it. Bronze Age.
I'm still Ed.
You are still Ed. I am so glad of that, still Ed.
Okay. And you are?
Still Levi.
Cool.
But cool. You can call me Limo. If you'd like.
Limo. Yeah, I've noticed that on Facebook.
Yeah, Limo.
Okay.
It's funny, I actually Googled Limo after the fact of adding that as my nickname. And I was scared at what some people had come up with concerning what that means. And I must say that the most prominent definition is most definitely not me.
I would say that is just ripe for some sort of Urban Dictionary kind of thing.
Oh, it is. It has to do with, well, just look it up. It'll be fun for you.
I'm sure it has to do with some sort of sexual deviation, because isn't that basically what Urban Dictionary is?
Pretty much.
Taking anything and making some sort of sexual innuendo type thing out of it.
Yeah.
So
it's, yeah. That's pretty much Urban Dictionary. If you want to know, you know, like what sexually they perverted something into, just go to Urban Dictionary.
Urban Dictionary is your lookup. Yeah.
Yep. Pretty much.
All right, guys. This is episode 9 tonight.
Nine
already.
It seems like 9 episodes ago that we started.
I know. Almost.
Hey, and you know what? We're doing better than last time because we don't have lost episodes.
No, this is true. This is true. We have some long episodes, but no lost episodes.
I blame that on the multiple small stories.
Yeah, that seems to be our recapping downfall.
Mm-hmm.
Episode 9 tonight, guys, we have our 2 Bronze Age Marvel books that we're going to spoil the heck out of. We have Sergeant Fury issue 76 and Silver Surfer issue 14. So with Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos 76, I should say.
And I think it should be mentioned, while that is the title for this specific issue, there were no Howling Commandos.
No, and there was really no Sergeant Fury.
No, not really. Well, okay, yeah, no. No Sergeant Fury, no.
The Sergeant Fury we know was there for like a page or two at the beginning and maybe a couple panels at the end, but mm-hmm. The story itself was not him.
No.
The cover gives us a good indication of what the story is, and oddly enough, Sergeant Fury is based in World War II, but on the cover we have 2 biplanes fighting it out, 1 German and 1 British, which to me brings to mind World War I.
Most definitely, yeah.
So the title, He Fought the Red Baron, which is roughly true. That's kind of a thing to get you to buy the book, but it didn't really turn out that way.
Well, I mean, everyone fought the Red Baron.
Even Snoopy.
I was just going to say that. I was literally Snoopy fought the Red Baron. So, okay, his claim to fame. Yeah, exactly. So his claim to fame is he fought the Red Baron. Okay, we'll see. Whatever.
Yeah, really. Yeah, you and Snoopy. Go ahead.
I think Phineas and Ferb actually fought the Red Baron at one time.
Did they too? Okay.
I think so, yeah.
They got to jump on that bandwagon too,
mm-hmm.
huh?
Yeah, so yeah, you fought the Red Baron. Okay, we'll see.
So I guess all of these people would be listed on the Red Baron's Wikipedia page down at the very bottom as other media or something that they always have for fictional characters.
That or references.
Yeah, okay. So Red Baron's got probably the biggest list ever.
He probably does. Seriously, it's like the people who have fought the Red Baron. And it's like since then, now, I mean, it's got to be what? At least in the hundreds.
Yeah. movies, TV shows,
books,
prose.
Yeah,
it's it's out of hand for sure.
I mean, the Red Baron is probably one of the most famous antagonists in aerial combat history. So,
oh, easily, yeah, he probably ranks pretty high as far as like period.
Oh yeah,
you know how many times or how well known he is by people. You know, that would be interesting to ask people a series of bad guys, just like an out on the street kind of thing, and see if people know who the Red Baron is. Other than pizza, I know somebody would say that.
Oh God, yeah, I didn't even.
Unfortunately, now that I think about that, so yeah, maybe that wouldn't work out.
Tell me the first thing that comes to mind when I say Red Baron. Crappy pizza. Okay, you fail. Go away.
Yeah. Okay. Cut. We won't use him.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, guys. This story opens with our Sergeant Fury talking to a British gentleman that turns out to be Sir Robert Hunt. They have become acquainted via the fact that Fury has been going out with Hunt's daughter, and I suppose either on purpose or as part of some socializing, she took Fury to meet her dad. They're having a conversation to open the story, and it turns out that they are linked by more than this social engagement we're watching. Apparently, Hunt knew Fury's dad, Jake Fury.
Papa Fury.
Papa Fury. And so the majority of this story is how and why Robert Hunt knew Jake Fury. So, as we indicated, Sergeant Fury is in the setup of the story and, you know, the bring it back around few panels at the end, but the majority of the story in between the actual meat of the book is about his dad, Jack Fury. And I think in all of my readings of Marvel Comics, Sergeant Fury is one of the lesser known characters that I've ever read about, but I don't believe I've ever read anything about his dad. So
neither have I, but you know, my reading is so extensive.
Okay. So our story takes us back from somewhere during World War II. We don't actually know when it starts, but it takes us back to 1916, which is when Mr. Hunt first made the acquaintance of Jack Fury. Hunt is in Europe. I don't think it really tells us if he's in Great Britain or the European mainland.
I assumed that he was in Great Britain.
Okay, it could very well be. Ultimately, we wind up at the French lines during World War II, so I thought that perhaps he was somewhere closer to that than on the British Isles.
Mm.
But there's no indication of where these initial meetings take place, but Fury has moved himself to the European front at this point, nearer the European front, because he wants to see some action. He's a pilot. He feels he is one of the best pilots ever, and he's not getting a chance to prove those skills with being on American soil. So he has moved himself. I don't get the impression that it's any kind of official military transfer or anything like that. He's kind of doing it on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to get a placement with British forces. Can't get in through any type of regular channels, so he basically just bulls his way through the underlings and the office to speak to Sir Robert Hunt, who is at this point a British officer attached to the British Air Services somehow. He tells Fury. Fury comes at him pretty hard and heavy, Sir Robert feels that perhaps this American is romanticizing things a little bit. So he tries to bring him down to earth with some, grab him by the shoulders and shake reality into him. We have a page of panels that illustrate the perhaps true plight of British air forces in the European front during World War One. European front. Were there any other fronts during your? I guess there were over in the Philippines and whatnot.
I'm sorry. World War One is not one of my specialties, so I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. I said European front. I'm not sure if there are any others to say European or just the front, but so we pull back after the, you know, here's what it's going to really be like, son, speech, and Fury is not deterred at all. So they shake on it. Hunt ends up, not at first. I'm sorry. At first, he has Fury sleep on it. Fury comes back to show him a little bit of his prowess in an airplane. So he jumps in one of the British biplanes here at the field. And for 2 pages or 3 pages, we see at about a page and a half, we see panel after panel of aerial maneuvers in a British biplane. I don't know enough really to give you what this is. I guess it could be a Sopwith Camel. I don't know. That's a name that sticks in my head as far as World War One British planes, but I don't know what it is. Anyways, he just flies it like a maniac, impresses Sir Robert. When he lands, Sir Robert tells him basically, you know, that he'll be his benefactor. He'll take him at his word, send him on to school to combat pilot training. Fury doesn't find that to his liking. Apparently, it's a little too slow for him. Also, he speaks out several times and is put in his place several times by Sir Robert. Ultimately, Fury passes the classroom flight training and is transferred to a unit on the front where he'll actually be flying for the British in association with the French against the Germans. The trip there, Fury, and he is not flying to the front alone. He has several companions. It's kind of hard to see exactly how many, 2 or 3 maybe, but they're attacked by Germans. And Fury has an opportunity to show some of his prowess, gets to the forward base, lands, and immediately starts exaggerating how good he is by inflating the numbers of enemy fighters that attacked him and that he dispatched.
Yeah.
It's recognized immediately by... I would say this is probably a French leader, although they don't have him speaking in any kind of accent. That he is told that that's no way for an officer to behave, that there's no reason to inflate the numbers. You know, if you really want to face those kind of numbers, you'll do that soon enough. You know, don't exaggerate. Some things start coming up here that drew my attention about this story. The words that were used, you know, I understand this comic book is coming out in 1970. It is being told by people in the 1940s about circumstances in the late 19-teens. So we have words that really are not popularly used today.
Yeah.
Later on in the story, some of these will come up. We haven't come across them yet, but one of the lower key ones is limey.
Yep.
In referring to the British people. But we have several words, one of which I've never heard in referring to the Germans.
Is that the B-O-C-H-E?
I picture that as Bosch.
Okay.
That's how I was saying it in my head. I looked it up, but I couldn't find a pronunciation of it. But yeah, that's the first of these, you know, I guess derogatory terms is what they would be,
mm-hmm.
That comes up. That is Fury, Jack Fury, the American, speaking to the French officer in charge of this forward aerodrome about the Germans that attacked him on his trip. And I guess, Levi, I guess they were in the British Isles because in that sequence we saw them flying over water.
Right. He had to do the and here's where my geography fails me. The
British Channel?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I, reflecting back on it, yeah, I assume that that's what they were trying to tell us, is that that was the British Channel. Interestingly enough, though, I don't know why so near the channel they were attacked by Germans with all of the Allied territory that the Germans would have had to fly over to get there.
Again, so, World War One was not my thing, so I don't know.
So, yeah, so I take that to mean that, yeah, Fury's initial meeting with Hunt was in the British Isles, and then he flew over the channel to the French forward lines to engage. But the word Bosch or Boche or Bochi, or I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but we also see Huns.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And we also see the ever-popular Heinies.
Yeah.
That I have seen a lot in reference to World War II more, but – also, so there we go. Huns, Heinies, and we'll say Bosch for the Germans, and Limey for the British.
And, of course, Yank for Americans.
Yeah, Yank. And these words are coming from the American,
mm-hmm.
Jack Fury predominantly. So, you know, I don't know if that is at the time what Americans were referring to these other peoples as in both the – you know, World War One and World War Two. If these are 70s words, you know, it's hard to tell how they're being applied, but they are being thrown out there. Or, I mean, from where they're being applied, it's easy to tell how they're being applied. So, just some interesting things about the verbiage that struck me. I saw one and I thought, well, you know, okay, I got, but when I got to two, I'm like, well, let me write these down mm-hmm. and see how many words they're going to use here. So,
and that was interesting also because – oh, and not to mention he did use kraut as well.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. He did. Yeah. And then in all fairness, now later on there's a German and he puts at the end of references.
Mm-hmm.
There's an Amerikaner and a there's another that the German pilot uses. But I didn't find that to be necessarily as derogatory as it was an attempt at showing an accent.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so Jake is set up, he's billeted, gets some rest, and very soon, the next morning, actually, there is an attack of the Bosch, we'll say. They're attacking this aerodrome. So Fury goes up with several British pilots. Several panels of the ensuing air battle, what I took from it is that Fury doesn't understand teamwork. He doesn't understand teamwork in that type of environment. And the British aren't too keen on the way this American does things. So at the end of that battle, Fury is actually grounded because of the way that he handled the dogfights, such to the extent that he hit at least one German plane, if not more, and I believe that his plane might have been strafed by, or not German, British, Allied mm-hmm. planes. And I believe his plane was potentially strafed by another ally because the lack of not only the lack of working together teamwork, but just the lack of understanding the necessity of teamwork by Fury. He just, you know, it's shown that he's putting himself and his allies at risk, in danger, because of his what they're wanting to show off as brash behavior, that American brashness that I think we're still fairly well known for worldwide. So they're showing it here in the story. All right, so now Fury is grounded, so our perspective now is going to shift to the Germans. And anytime you speak of Germans in World War One at the front, of course the Red Baron comes into play, particularly if you're talking about flyboys. So, sure enough, here we go. We see the Red Baron as he is terrorizing both the air and the ground. We have scenes of him strafing the French peasantry. later on at some point, you know, after some number of missions here, the Germans have all gotten together, and the Red Baron is touting his virility with a stick. Or no, wait a minute. His ability to fly his airplane, I mean. And we have one of his compatriots say, wow, you know, you really are something else. But hey, have you heard anything about this American that is flying for the Englanders, they say, which actually that may be appropriate. Englanders, that could be. Mm. You know, so basically one of the Red Baron's own dudes is telling him, you know, hey, yeah, you're good, but there's somebody else here that we've been hearing is pretty good. You know, what do you think? And of course, the Red Baron tells him, well, you know, we'll just see tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We'll go shake his tree and see if we can get him to come out and play a little bit. So the next day, the Germans, led by the Red Baron, or a contingent of the Germans anyways, attacks this forward aerodrome where Fury has been assigned, and he's grounded. So he sees his boys take off and go to battle, but he is not able to do anything at first. But as the casualties on the Allied side starts piling up, Fury decides that he's just going to jump into an available plane that functions, because that's also another thing that has come up several times in the story, is that, you know, it's not just the destroyed plane, but it's the incapacitated planes that are proving a problem also. Mm-hmm. They're starting to run low. So he finds an able-bodied plane and takes off, much to the chagrin of his commander. And up in the air, he starts doing his thing. He's proving his mettle, taking out some of the Germans, not taking out the Red Baron, not even facing the Red Baron. The Red Baron, though, figures after some successes that his boys have things in hand, and I believe that the Red Baron determines to take off back home.
Mm-hmm.
and let his boys mop up. So the Red Baron and Fury never actually meet. But Fury is, you know, still engaged, outnumbered. His commanding officer takes off in a plane, and at one point saves Fury by taking bullets meant for Fury, his own plane being shot down, the commanding officer's.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it that Fury kind of stops. He gets out of battle, disengages, to go check on the commanding officer, and that's kind of where the battle ends.
Yeah.
The Germans pretty much win, in my mind. They do superior damage. They take our hero out of the story, mm-hmm. you know, forcing him to land to check on his quote-unquote buddy, mm-hmm. his commanding officer, that he seems to have built an affection for, but they really didn't have much of an affection building.
I don't think it's so much as an affection as it is a respect. He gave me a chance.
Okay.
Set me straight. He yanked me up.
Right. Okay.
He put me in a plane.
I got you.
I respect that man.
I got you. So Fury ends up saving the man's life. We find the ever pervasive tearjerker story about the soldier now that will not be able to fight in his accustomed way because mm-hmm. the commander is burned and is somewhat crippled. I'm not sure what that means.
No, I'm sorry. You're either crippled in some way or you're not. You're not somewhat crippled.
Well, I don't know. Perhaps the nurse here, maybe she's a little pregnant. I don't
yeah, exactly.
Know. It's the same thing.
Maybe the doctor's a little daft.
Maybe, yeah. So Fury leaves him.
I'm only a little pregnant.
Continues on. Do what?
I'm only a little pregnant. It'll be okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It's just – that's such a stupid term.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, it's – yeah. Fury, we see he continues on effectively killing Germans, getting promotions. You know, he hero, big mucky muck and all this kind of stuff. And that's basically where Sir Robert finishes his tale. And – the last panel of the story kind of made me laugh, really. Fury is standing in a window watching a group of airplanes pass in front of the moon, and he's thinking, I got some thinking to do about things like heroes and humility and my crazy old man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Fury retro or introspective, introspection. Yeah, I'm not too familiar with that.
No, not really. But, of course, you know, this is the first time his old man has been talked about, so.
Yeah, I guess so. Let me flip back here a minute. I believe I forgot to say anything about the creative peeps on this one.
You did. And while you're doing that, I looked up that B-O-C-H-E word.
Okay.
And actually, Wiki seems to have a rather large – well, not large, but somewhat long – list of, shall we say, derisive slang?
Synonyms for that?
Well, not synonyms, but not synonyms as in that word means also this or this or this, but a list of additional words that were derisive that were applied to Germans.
Okay. Well...
It's actually pronounced Boshi, so you were right.
Boshi, okay.
It's a derisive term used by the French during World War I. Often collectively, meaning the Germans.
Okay.
Now, here's according to a 1916 article in the New York Times magazine Current History, the origin is as follows, and I will greatly paraphrase. Its origins are from a reference to heads of cabbage.
Well, I've heard cabbage heads, krauts. So
yeah. Okay. So it was meant to infer German blockhead or imbecile.
Well, I wonder why Germans were associated with cabbage.
Because of, let's see here, because of the French term. Let's see here. It's derived from, and I'm going to butcher this.
That's okay. We're Americans. We're allowed.
Allemand or German and kabochi or kabochi, which is head or cabbage.
Interesting. Okay. Boshi. I'll have to remember that.
So this is recognized French word. This is a recognized French word used familiarly for head, especially a big, thick head or a low pate.
So they're calling the Germans thick heads.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. And we have this American coming to Britain.
Yeah.
Transferring to the French lines, who has knowledge of this particular rather local word.
French. Yeah. French term.
Okay.
Yeah, there was Dutch, there was Hun, there was French, Fritz, there was Heine, there was Herman, Jerry, Kraut, I think Teuton, and then there was Boshi is the list that they have. So, one, two, three, four in this comic alone.
Yeah, and most of those I've heard in, you know, movies. Mm-hmm. A couple of those in the Captain America movie. Okay, and the creators for this particular piece were, not Stan Lee. We had G. Frederick and Bill Everett as writers. Dick Ayers was the penciler, John Severin the inker, and Gene Izzo was the letter. Stan Lee was just the editor on this one, apparently.
Mm.
I thought at one point, though, he had written Sergeant Fury. I don't recall precisely. So, alrighty. Do you want to what are your thumb thoughts on this one?
Well, it's... I've mentioned it before concerning comics like these. It's very interesting to look at the play We're dealing with 1960s, 1970s time period of it being written. About right. a 1940s time that it's supposed to happen. But like you mentioned, now in a 1940s, mid-40s comic, they're referencing the 1916, 1917. So right. it's really interesting to see the slang that they use, and it's really seriously interesting to see what they got away with.
Oh man, yeah.
Then
yeah, without a doubt.
Because if slangs were and well slung now in comics like they were for this comic, somebody would get jerked up.
Oh yeah, there'd be all kinds of grief coming from just all kinds of avenues at, yeah. Aimed at the company.
Yeah. So I mean it's interesting just to see what they, I guess, got away with, but I don't think that they really got away with it. I think that that was the norm at the time.
Yeah, I don't think it was an issue. Definitely not like it is now. And in a way, that's kind of unfortunate in a way. Not that I'm a fan of, you know, using terms like that for anybody, but if that's the way people thought, and more importantly, that's the way people spoke about other people.
Sure, absolutely.
It's not, you know, it's not intended as a slam. It's more a realistic, you know, a more realistic portrayal than not using those words.
Well, I mean, it would be period piece, and I can yeah. respect that. And so, but
even given today, doing that. People like what comes to mind is phraseology that was used in the Western Durango or
Django.
Yeah, the way that the black people were spoken to and treated.
Western, dude.
Well, a Civil War.
Well, but it wasn't a Western. It was actually this side. But yeah, that's what's funny is that's the exact movie that I had in mind while you were like, you know, a good example is with you know, with a movie like Django, listening to the terms and how they were used and the fact that they were appropriate while still being offensive and of course being offensive to those that they would have been used on or leveled against. I think it allows for a greater understanding of just how bad – no, not how bad. The thought processes and the allowances behind and by the people at the time.
Right, right.
And so it's interesting reading, you know, the comics and seeing that same thing, what was allowed and what even maybe they thought was, you know how people spoke. So, you know, it's just it's like a little time capsule, and it's interesting to read.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And now the panels of the flight and the maneuvers and everything, those were pretty cool.
Yes, they were.
I actually did really enjoy those a lot. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to give it a thumbs down.
Okay.
I just didn't think that it had enough oomph. And then I thought that the ending overall was generally kind of weak.
It kind of just got left off. It didn't.
I mean, it was like, and that's the story, and you have a good day, son. And then, you know, Nick's like, I've got some thinking to do.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So, meh, no.
I'll give it a thumbs down as well. My biggest issue that I had with it was that it wasn't Fury. And I don't know, I'm really not interested in his dad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested really in a tale from World War One.
Mm-hmm.
There have been other comic books out there that, if that's what I was after, you know, I would read those books. So it just, I don't know. And it didn't really add to how or why Fury was the way he is. I mean, there was no character building really.
No.
So I wondered, well, what exactly was your point?
And it really didn't add to the character line or the storyline of the current comic either.
No. It was not only did it feel like a fill-in story that they, you know, just paid somebody to write, but it was by people, it seemed, who actually had no concept of what the book was supposed to be.
Yeah, it was like a side thought.
Yeah, so, you know, here you go, I wrote this, and then somebody came in and said, okay, now how can we connect this? Oh, okay, so you had the beginning and ending framing, and that story in the, yeah, it just, it felt really, really odd. And I'm a, you know, I'm a big fan that if you're going to do something, do it in the character's continuity, or don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, or, yeah, so, continuity, or at least have it to where the ending has, like, very real relevance to something that's going on that you're seeing as you're reading the comic.
Right, right. Yeah. A current storyline kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like, you know, oh, well, he died, but his enemy lived, and his grandchild is now the one that you're fighting.
Right, right, yeah.
And he's held on to that animosity, blah, 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 whatever. Something like that. Tie it in. But, yeah, this issue was – it almost felt like a one-off, honestly. It felt like a –
yeah.
A pilot.
Okay, yeah. The Adventures of Jack Fury.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like a – almost like a pilot. Like, it's like, you think we could also – well, why don't we – yeah, that flopped. All right, we won't do it.
Yeah.
All right.
All righty. Do you want to move on and do the second book, or do you want to cut it here?
No, let's go.
All right. All right, guys, moving on, we have Silver Surfer issue 14.
Am I allowed to give my thumbs up or down at the beginning of the show for this one? Or do I have to wait?
No, you can do it beforehand if you want to. Go ahead.
Oh, but then it'll spoil all the fun for the listeners.
Oh, will it? Okay. All right. I have the person that sent us the word of the show, Professor Allen, also indicated that he was particularly interested in this, in our thoughts on this issue of Silver Surfer. So, Professor Allen, here you go. You can perk up. I believe it's because on one of his episodes upcoming of one of his podcasts, he has three, he must be going to be talking about the same issue. So I don't know that for sure, but he just said he would be listening to it very closely, is what he tweeted. So
okay, all right. Maybe then it's a good thing that I didn't offer my
at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry.
All right.
Professor.
So we we start off with kind of, in my mind, a deceptive cover. It's the Silver Surfer is titled, but we start off at the top of the cover with a big shot of Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say at this point, Spider-Man is probably the flagship character of Marvel Comics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
In 1970?
Yeah.
I mean, he's even been on Electric Company. Come mm-hmm. on.
That, and at that time, that right there shows you how cool he was.
Oh, yeah, he's going up against Silver Surfer.
No, I mean that he was on Electric Company.
Oh, Electric Company, yeah. Him and Easy Reader.
Yeah.
That was, yeah. So he is engaged with Silver Surfer on the cover. They want you to think that they're fighting, but basically what it is they're just moving towards each other. There's no real striking of each other or anything like that as far as the cover is concerned.
Like a real engagement. They're moving toward each other. No real striking, but...
Yeah, no striking, nobody being thrown, exactly. Nobody, you know, they're just moving in.
Yep.
All right, now this one, I'll do the creative team up front here where I should.
Because, it's on the first page.
Yes. This is written by Stan Lee, drawn by John Buscema, with inks by Dan Atkins and lettered by Sam Rosen. So we start out... The title of this story appears to be The Surfer and the Spider, which kind of just has a cool ring to it.
It does, and it also makes me think of, like, possibilities for 1950s movies.
Oh, yes, definitely. We start with the Silver Surfer in near-Earth proximity. He sees that a meteor is heading toward Earth, and it's going to pass perilously close. And as he's watching the trajectory, he sees that another incoming meteor is actually going to collide with this first meteor. And it will, let's see, his words are, at the speed they're traveling, it will be like a hydrogen explosion. So, oddly enough, to prevent this explosion, what the Silver Surfer does is he hunkers down on his surfboard and he sends it at light speed to intercept between the two meteors before they collide. And when he gets in position, he shoots with his power cosmic both meteors, causing them to explode, which is what they would have done if they collided.
But not with the power of a hydrogen bomb.
Apparently not, because it's what he did.
Exactly.
So, if that isn't 70s Bronze Age goofy enough for you, as far as this goes, in the explosion, the fragments of meteor fly everywhere, and one strikes Silver Surfer, knocking him, if not unconscious, senseless. He starts to fall towards the Earth, being dislodged from his surfboard. All of these things really aren't supposed to happen to the Silver Surfer.
No.
The Silver Surfer, the surfboard, is more or less part of him.
Mm-hmm.
He is covered by some sort of alloy that he was covered with by Galactus that is supposed to protect him from the rigors of space.
Right.
I would think the rigors of space are a little harsher than a meteoroid impact.
Well, okay.
So,
we
just have volumes of goofiness, in my mind, starting in this very introspective kind of thinking character's story. And so I'm just like, wow, really? This is how this story starts?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you've got, oh my God, these two are going to collide and it's going to destroy the Earth. And here, I'll just shoot them instead. And I get hit by a chunk of rock and I'm knocked out. And I lose my board, and I'm falling towards the Earth. I mean, it's like, why are you a superhero again, dude?
It's like, no doubt. I guess dude hasn't gotten to any of those chapters yet. He's not read up.
I guess. But I do – one of the things – and it's what? Page 3. Okay. Excuse me. Page 3. One of the things that I really loved was – what they said, which was he struck by a hurtling chunk of rock-hard debris.
Yes, okay.
Okay, now think about that. They're meteorites. I'm sorry, they're meteors.
Meteors, right.
Rock-hard debris.
So they're saying as opposed to gelatinous debris?
Well, that was my thinking. Or foam.
Right.
Hard
or,
debris.
Okay.
And I was just like, really? Like, no, he was struck by water.
Well, yes. The implication, I assume, is when you destroy meteors with the power cosmic, there are other types of debris. And so they had to separate and let you know that a piece of the rock-hard debris is what struck him.
Well, I mean, having never wielded the power cosmic, I am vastly ignorant on what happens when I use it. So
okay. Yeah, admittedly, we are right.
I admit that.
So after being struck by a piece of rock hard debris, and plummeting to the Earth's surface
helplessly,
the Silver Surfer strikes, fortunately, ocean, which I guess he's got, what, a 75% chance or so?
Ish.
So it that worked out to his benefit, and he just, you know, straight to the bottom. Very near some ships. Figure the odds there. But
well, I mean, because, you know, ships are all over. So.
I guess, yeah. So he is at the bottom, all mucked up here, but he is slowly revived by the cooling currents. That's their words, not mine.
Because space was so hot for him.
Yes, yes. His first thought is that he doesn't have his board, so he calls it to him.
Well, I mean, now, to be honest, that's any surfer's first thought when they wake up.
Well, heck yeah.
Dude, where's my board?
No doubt. Especially if it's not attached to that strap at your ankle.
Exactly.
You know, you definitely want to find it.
Yep.
We cut to somewhere on the surface, an apartment where we have a young child that is watching a Captain America, looks like a serial cartoon. And we see that he is also a fan of not just Captain America, but Marvel Comics, because he has a Captain America, a Submariner, and a Fantastic Four comic.
No account for taste, but okay.
He's that's not right. He's a young lad, so these are his escape mechanisms. His dad is not appreciative of this method of
escapism.
Escape him spending his time at all.
Right.
He says he's too wrapped up in this Captain America world, you know, with the TV and the comic books and the boy, which I'm surprised didn't get him a backhand at this point.
Yeah, right. Says,
but I enjoy them, just like you enjoy your golf. And and the dad just tells him to quit arguing and go to his room.
I know. It's like, but Dad, you like your golf. Smack.
No doubt. That's okay, so the kid goes to his room, and while he's there, he sees the Silver Surfer, who he recognizes by name. I'm not sure how. I guess Silver Surfer must have a comic book out at this time.
Well, I mean, he's got to.
Is what they're saying. But he recognizes him. The Surfer's still kind of fuzzy. He's on his board, but he's kind of almost on both knees, you know, squatting on the board, because he has directed it, I guess, to move somewhere. And it's just ambling about with him not in full command of his self. So he's just staggering around almost on his surfboard here in the city.
Drugged or hit or whatever, and they stumble around. They don't know where they're going. They're moved by their legs, right?
Right, right. Yeah. They, right.
Okay. So if the board is basically an extension of him, well, then the board is going to do what legs would normally do, which is move around aimlessly and do whatever. So, I mean, I can see where, you know, him and the board are like, you know, oh, I don't know where I'm going. I'm so out of it. And so I can see that part.
Okay. Okay.
Random, you know, having nothing to do with anything. But yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. You're right. And I guess that's what they're trying to portray, is that's kind of his reaction. He stumbles around on his surfboard rather mm-hmm. than a regular person would just stumble around on their legs, having just been knocked senseless and just coming to. We have Spider-Man's appearance here. He's zipping around, doing a drive-by, basically. He's on patrol, I guess. And he accidentally encounters the Silver Surfer in that he misjudges a web shot to swing, and in trying to make up for it, he shoots another web that he catches the Surfer's surfboard with.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the Surfer flying around, kind of, you know, out of it, realizing that this thing, this person, has attached itself to the bottom of his board and is dangling there.
Mm-hmm.
And then Spider-Man is like, well, that's the Silver Surfer, and something is wrong because I inadvertently webbed his board and he's pulling me along. Well, that's just not right.
Yeah.
You know. So they immediately they become antagonistic. At this point, I'm pretty sure that the Silver Surfer doesn't have the best reputation with, you know, the denizens of Earth or the Earth heroes. But this just all of a sudden, I did something, and here it is, and now it's a bad thing kind of thing that Spider-Man goes through just kind of threw me.
Yeah, it – okay.
You know, I would almost figure he would joke it off or something.
Well, Spider-Man, yeah. That's what I would expect from him. You know, some snarky teenage, whoa, I caught your board by accident.
Yeah, something.
You know, sorry – whatever quippy thing you'd call him.
Right, yeah. Surfer dude, or whatever.
Destro. Ooh, see that reference? All right, I'm done.
Yeah. So the surfer is even more antagonistic in that he perceives this as some sort of attack and doesn't recognize Spider-Man at all. So they kind of exchange words, and then Spider-Man webs up Surfer's head.
Yeah.
And pulls him off his surfboard. Okay. So he's got one hand holding onto the surfboard by mm-hmm. a web, and mm-hmm. now he has taken the Silver Surfer with another web and pulled him off his surfboard. So Spider-Man is kind of like in between, holding the – well, he now lets go of the Silver Surfer. So that he can fall, I guess, or whatever, holding onto the board. And as he's falling, the Silver Surfer commands his surfboard to save him. So now Spider-Man is being whipped around in that comedic kind of rope on a car, horse, whatever kind of thing.
Sure.
As the surfboard is whooshing around to get underneath Silver Surfer and catch him.
Wait, what's the board doing again?
It's whooshing.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that the sound it would make?
Again, having not had a cosmic silver surfboard,
I think that's the official sound for a cosmically powered surfboard.
Is whoosh.
Whoosh, yeah. Okay. I think that's –
okay.
Yeah. So it does – get Silver Surfer, who immediately now shoots the webbing that Spider-Man is using to hold him attached while simultaneously shooting a fire hydrant. So he dislodges Spider-Man, but he shoots a fire hydrant knowing that the water is going to spray out to cushion Spider-Man's fall.
Yes.
Because he's an antagonist. He's potentially attacking me, but I still don't want to hurt him. You know, I want to try to make this as easy as possible for him. And what I'm saying that as my perception of Silver Surfer's thinking as he's going through all this.
Mm-hmm.
So he does, and it works, and he just zips on off, leaving Spider-Man helplessly bouncing on this, you know, big gush of water out of the fire hydrant that's shattered.
See, Iceman could help him right there.
Yes, absolutely. And so could Firestar.
She could.
But that's in a completely different cartoon.
It is.
Silver Surfer still isn't completely collected because in all his whooshings around, he manages to fly back past this building that had the young boy in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the boy sees him again, and we see that Silver Surfer still isn't, you know, really completely about himself. Well, this time the boy is going to try to catch up with Silver Surfer. And let me just mention that Silver Surfer interrupts the boy while he's reading a Thor comic book now. So we're getting the entire Marvel run.
Oh,
here.
Yeah, look at there. He is, isn't he?
And there's a couple other books here, but the titles aren't quite drawn to where you can make them out. But he's stretched out on his bed with a whole bunch of them around him.
Yeah.
Which is – that's just the preferred, you know, 8, 9, or 10-year-old method of reading comics, I must admit. He's going to catch up with the Silver Surfer this time, so he rushes out of his apartment up onto the roof because he thought he saw that that's where the Surfer was going and was going to end up on his roof. So he gets up there. the little boy does, and he's hiding behind a chimney, spying on the Silver Surfer, who is sitting on a ledge there on the roof, still confused about where he is and what's happened and who Spider-Man is and what all's going on. And he's kind of soliloquying here, the Silver Surfer is. Now he starts to ponder about Zen-La, which is the planet that he's from. So here we get we're starting to tap into his melancholy side.
Can I just insert a lasai here, please?
Yes, that's it. Now, Spider-Man has caught up with him, and we see the Spider-Man quippy, "Okay, Mr. Clean," because Silver Surfer in his suit has a bald dome, and yeah, so they go back and forth a little bit here with the verbiage, and Silver Surfer, Spider-Man definitely comes on like he's attacking Silver Surfer. Perhaps not violently physically, but definitely with his words. Silver Surfer perceives it that way. Not only does he perceive it as he's being attacked, but he perceives himself as a victim who is being attacked.
Not as
somebody that can stand up to the attack and not really worry about it, but just brush it off. No, this is a, "Oh, how terrible of you," to kind of thing. And so,
yeah,
that is the interaction at this point between the two. Finally, Silver Surfer does go on the offensive, as does Spider-Man in retaliation. He completely webs up the Surfer this time. And in doing so, the Surfer tumbles over the side of the building, but gets caught on the fire escape. He falls onto the fire escape rather than falling on down, you know, the many stories into the street. So they're still talking. Silver Surfer's trying to explain what he may or may not be wanting to do. Spider-Man is still being very aggressive about the only thing I can think of is that the Silver Surfer must really have a bad rep, because Spider-Man's just being really aggressive with him.
He is, but he – okay. Here's the thing I got, is that he doesn't necessarily, like, know him, but, like, as a superhero, like, he's heard some things, you know? And it's
right,
like,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Well, this dude, isn't like me. And the biggest thing is just, like, in this issue, Spider-Man is really being verbally antagonistic.
Yes, definitely.
And for no apparent reason.
Definitely, I mean, reason enough, I don't think. I mean,
it just seems to be very out of character for Spider-Man right now.
He wasn't given cause so far to be as aggressive as he is.
No, not at all.
So they're going back and forth, exchanging things. The Silver Surfer heats up a piece of the fire escape and causes Spider-Man, you know, to have to let go. And he escapes and falls on down the building, Spider-Man does. Meanwhile, Silver Surfer realizes that he can break out of this webbing, that he is power cosmically powered and can, you know, throw off the webbing. They go back and forth a bit until they take it down to the street. And no sooner do they get to the street that the police are there waiting for them, and they realize, hey, the police do. We need some backup.
Yep.
So they call for backup, and the police don't respond as backup. The U.S. military responds as backup. Here in the middle of, I would assume, New York, because I think that's where Spider-Man is in the Marvel Universe,
yeah,
is in New York City.
Yeah.
So now we have helicopters, jeeps, troop carrying trucks and tanks. Okay, downtown. Because now with Spider-Man and Silver Surfer battling, and you guys can't see it, but I use the quotes here, they have to evacuate, you know, however many blocks, mm-hmm, around the battle, the military does. So they're doing this. We see the young boy's dad, who is being forcibly evacuated because he doesn't have his son with him, wants to go back and get him. And of course, that's an opportunity for us to flash to what the sun is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in a moment of foreshadowing, we see that the sun is still on top of his building, playing on top of Silver Surfer's inert surfboard.
Yes.
Oh, gee, what's going to happen here? So Surfer and Spidey are still going at it. There's an interesting panel here, and I guess what we're meant to see is that the Silver Surfer has picked up a car and wrapped it around Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what it looked like to me is the Silver Surfer shot a car that was flying through the air.
That's what it looks like, yeah.
Yeah, but I guess it's meant that he picks it up because he then wraps it around Spider-Man and entombs him in it. So
I don't think he wrapped it around him. What I got looking at, like, from one panel where it's, like, swinging around the building and he's shooting it, Silver Surfer, mm-hmm. to the okay. next panel where Spider-Man is, like, literally in the middle of the carnage of – well, not in the middle, encased. Okay. In the middle of the remnants of the vehicle is that he did, like, a cosmic switch and, like – I don't know, phased Spider-Man into it.
Okay.
And then solidified it.
Okay.
That's what it looks like.
Right.
You know, so I don't know.
Right. So you're thinking, I think, a little bit more like, you know, hocus pocusy than I am. I'm thinking he just took the car and just like physically bent it around Spider-Man.
Yeah, and I'm thinking there was more of like a phase shift thing going on because it is the power cosmic.
Yeah, it is. It is. And the vagaries thereof are a mystery to us.
Yes. Us mere mortals.
All right. So we Spider-Man does manage to break free. Silver Surfer left him. He kind of delayed Spider-Man. And he knew Spider-Man wasn't defeated per se, but he used that as an opportunity to just leave this battle.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't want it and he was just leaving. So Spider-Man gets out. As he does, the military has gathered and has focused on the Silver Surfer, I guess because they recognize Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
and they open fire on the Silver Surfer.
Well, it is said by one of the soldiers something akin to, I never thought that he or Spider-Man would be on our side. One of the soldiers...
Yeah. So. Yeah, later on. I think that was about the Silver Surfer. Because of what happens next with the boy. Well, go ahead and see if you can find that. I'll go through here what's happening.
Yeah, continue.
The Silver Surfer is being fired on by the military and realizes that he just needs to get out. So, of course, he calls a surfboard. And as we saw previously, the little boy, Jakey, whatever his name is on the surfboard when it gets called. Now, using his power, the Silver Surfer is able to basically protect himself from all of this standard ordnance that is being fired at him. But in calling the surfboard, he realizes that the boy is there. So he determines that he needs to save the boy. He doesn't want to hurt him. And so he focuses his attention and diverts the majority of his energies towards ensuring that the boy is not hurt in bringing the surfboard to him, the Silver Surfer. In doing, his defenses are reduced towards protecting himself against the barrage of ordnance that is coming his way. He finally does get the boy settled to the ground, and at some point in doing this, everyone realizes that what Silver Surfer is doing. He's not fighting. He's defending himself, but not only that, he's protecting this boy. So they stop firing. Dad runs to get the boy. Spider-Man realizes, wow, you know, this Silver Surfer dude must not be too bad. He sacrificed protecting himself to protect this boy, although it wasn't much of a sacrifice. I mean, Silver Surfer wasn't like really hurt, but he didn't lash out or do anything. You know, all his energies were towards protecting the boy. So Spider-Man leaves with, you know, maybe a little bit changed attitude towards or it changed perceptions to what they previously were towards the Silver Surfer. The military men who now are, you know, retreating and going back to wherever they came from are thinking basically the same thing. And the Silver Surfer, here, this final panel, if you have not read the Silver Surfer before, the rest of the book, it's kind of tough to pick up exactly on what this character has been like. To me, there were bits and pieces that really showed him. But this last panel, Silver Surfer is kneeling on the ground, his surfboard next to him, rubble strewn all around. The people that were witnessing are now dispersing away, okay? And the Silver Surfer is thinking to himself, "And when I am weak and spent, they turn to leave. No longer do they seek to slay me. Perhaps there still is hope for them. Perhaps one day they will renounce all use of force, for only then at last will mankind come of age." And so that pretty much at this point in his career sums up the personage that they have given the Silver Surfer. Or not they, actually Stan Lee, has, because Silver Surfer was a pet project of Stan Lee.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Stan, so did you get any clarification on what you were thinking?
No, I must have just been completely off. The only thing that I found that was remotely related to what I was trying to say was a soldier saying, "There's not a man here who take arms against the Surfer now." So I'm not sure. Right. I'm not sure what I was thinking. Evidently, I was just completely off. So, sorry
okay.
about that.
And that was in reference, right, to him having protected the boy.
Yeah, they obviously saw that while they were firing, he's protecting the boy, and you know, he wasn't attacking them. He wasn't doing anything aggressive, and he was, you know, actually just trying to save the child. So,
right. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so that pretty much is Silver Surfer 14, guys. Levi, what did you think? Thumbs up, down, sideways?
Professor, I'm not sure if you like it or not. I'm going to have to give it a thumbs down. And,
okay.
And I'm going to actually have to give it a double thumbs down. I think this was possibly one of the poorest written storylines for a comic that we've done.
Ouch.
For the show this season, it was just too contrived for me. While the Surfer did, for the most part, stay true to himself,
right,
which is not a positive. I am not a fan of the Surfer.
No.
but my biggest thing is that I thought that they very poorly displayed Spider-Man.
Okay. Okay.
The Surfer, you know, his "I don't want to fight, I don't want to fight. You are, you know, you humans are barbaric," and you know, okay, I get that. And you know, they portrayed that well, and you know, they made it so that, you know, push, push, push. Finally, the Surfer pushed back. He responded, okay, that Surfer. Spider-Man, that antagonistic for no reason, that was horribly out of character for Spidey, in my opinion.
Oh. Okay, okay.
And I think, honestly, that the writers just – I think they wanted a headliner story, I think, is what they wanted, and they just they should have either chosen a bad guy or chosen a good guy who was more hot-headed.
Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Than Spider-Man, and because I mean, honestly, I can see, you know, 30 Ways to Sunday Spider-Man getting out of it, avoiding it, trying to, you know, web out of conflict, trying to, you know, be like, whoa, 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 you know, calm down, it, you know, So this was actually, in my opinion, a really bad issue.
Okay. I'll concur with the thumbs down. My biggest issue was just the portrayal of Spider-Man in this. Like so many other characters, I believe Spider-Man was probably just pulled into the book to try to boost sales.
Yeah.
Particularly with the prominence he had on the cover.
Right.
And so not only, you know, was that the main motivation for even having him in the story, but in the story, he was, and oddly enough, this is Stan Lee.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. He set up the way Spider-Man was going to be used.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in just pulling Spider-Man into the story, misused him.
Yeah.
The portrayal was off. That's it. The portrayal of Spider-Man was just off.
Yeah.
This wasn't Spider-Man. This
no.
was some other villain in Spider-Man's suit.
Well, okay, now
so,
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say that he was a villain because he didn't try and follow through. He didn't have nefarious intentions.
Okay, yeah, that's true. That's true.
It's almost like it was another person who had Spidey's abilities and costume that didn't have, shall we say, the morals of Peter Parker.
Okay.
That to me is what it felt like. And I know this is kind of silly, but it's almost like it was a betrayal.
Sure. Yeah, I could see that. If you were a fan of Spider-Man
exactly.
and had been reading him and then you saw, oh, cool, he's going to be in this, mm-hmm. and you picked it up. Yeah, this is not – yeah. So, Stan, I'm not sure, dog, what you were, you know, intending to do, but this just missed.
This was a fail. I mean, like, a fail.
This missed. So – all right, there we go, guys. We had Sergeant Fury 76, which we both gave a thumbs down to, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we follow that up quickly with Silver Surfer 14 that we both gave a thumbs down to.
Yep.
Next episode, we have lined up Submariner 23 and Thor 174, both of which I think will be a little bit more along our comic book tastes, rather than a World War II fighter and Silver Surfer, which is easily a superhero is a stretch to describe what Silver Surfer is at this point. So,
you know
he's super, yes.
He's definitely super. Now, there was something that I actually forgot to mention.
Okay.
With the boy riding the surfboard of Silver Surfer.
Okay.
It was interesting because while he's riding it, you can almost go back. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of the comics that we did last episode. It almost looked like the boy was riding on top of a stagecoach while he was riding the surfboard.
Almost, yeah. You could almost envision like that Wild West terrain zipping by.
Exactly, and you know, it's that trying to, you know, to stand up on something that you're not familiar with, but it's doing all kinds of, you know, like funky things. You're used to walking on solid ground, and here it is like zipping and you know doing all these things. It almost looked like if you could. Just think of him like in a cowboy hat, you know?
Yeah.
A vest and chaps and boots, and he's trying to stand on top of a stagecoach while it's, you know, barreling down like this Arizona dirt track.
I see it. I can picture it.
Yeah. So
I'm there. So there we go, Professor Allen, via Twitter. There was your word of the show, stagecoach. And thank you for giving us such a heavily themed word. Mm. The episode after we discussed that theme, that was very ingenious of you. We appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you for participating. Absolutely. So
I gotta tell you, in all honesty, he has been very enjoyable with his interactions.
Yes.
I mean, it's just it's fun to hear what he has to say, and also, you know, his challenges. So, Professor Allen, Excelsior.
All right, guys, there we are with this episode. The two issues we're talking about next time, should you choose to read ahead, the appropriate salutations and thank yous to our listeners, Professor Allen in particular, for helping us with the word of the show. I think that is everything that we were probably wanting to discuss this episode. Levi, do you have anything else?
I have nothing else, no.
All right. Well, then there we go, guys. We will see you in a fortnight. Oh, yes, some contact info. Well,
that's always helpful.
You could tweet Professor Allen to find our Twitter, because he does use it rather extensively. It is Marvel Bronze Age if you look for it.
That's for those tweety things.
Yes, the tweeters, so that you can. Yes, you can leave tweeters.
Yes.
We are the Marvel Bronze Age on Facebook and Google Plus. It's just Marvel Bronze Age on Twitter. No, the. TheMarvelBronzeAge@gmail.com is the email, should you wish to interact that way. And BigTimeNoise.com/MarvelBronzeAge, no, the, is the website. So those are the preferred methods, and actually the only methods to socialize with us. Use them appropriately, and we will see you guys in a fortnight.
A fortnight.
Ciao, all.
Yo.
The Marvel Bronze Age podcast is a Teal production, and as such is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, non-derivatives 3.0 unported license. The song Super Freaks is provided and performed by the Hammerheads.